Sarah Sivia, welcome to the Humans of Agriculture podcast. I've got it on good intelligence that you are a bit of an avid listener, first-time story sharer. I think our audience that have come with us, and we've actually just ticked over 4 years of the podcast, 238 plus.
I saw that. I listened to you and Millie having that chat. Yeah, it's great. Congratulations.
Thank you. No, well, I feel like the lucky one because I really just bring people on to chat about things that I'm interested in and looking to learn off, and I think others will probably benefit from it as well. And I think your background, well, when Millie first spoke to you, she said, I'm really excited for this podcast. Sarah is so interesting. It could go here, there, and everywhere. And I think looking at your CV, we've got chemical engineer, studied at Oxford, has an MBA, worked for Syngenta in Switzerland, came home, worked for Rabobank, another friend of our show, which we'll share a little bit more on in the next few weeks. And then coming back into the family business and what that looked like, coming back maybe with intent, but also with eyes wide open of what is happening out there. Not, and when we say the world, we literally mean the world, big consumer markets. You're running an egg business, as you kind of touched on, but can you tell us a little bit about where are you joining us from? And if we were sitting in your shoes, what would we be seeing today?
Super cool question, and I'm not feeling any pressure whatsoever. Great. Thanks. Thanks for that intro. Excellent. Well, I am sitting, where are we? We're on the Allen River, which is at the base of the Barrington Tops. We're about an hour and a half north of Newcastle, 40 minutes from Dungog. That sort of might give a few people a bit of a feel of where we are. I am actually sitting in a new building we've just built, and we might touch on that a little bit later, but that's going to be part of an agritourism venture, which is our sort of next bit of diversification. And the view I'm getting, aside from you on screen, Ollie, obviously, is extraordinary, like straight over the top of the laptop. I'm looking out at the Pinnacle, which we run all our cattle, chickens, and yeah, look, it's a pretty stunning view, and I'm hoping others will enjoy it when we open the venue.
You might have to just send us a photo of it so we have an idea of what we're missing out on from here in sunny Geelong.
I tried sitting out there, and I couldn't. The reflection was extraordinary, so I was like, yeah, no, I need to go inside.
No, yeah. Well, thank you for doing that for us.
It's not too easy.
Now, a podcast you've got, which is one of your favourites, How I Built This with Guy Raz. He talks to a whole bunch of different entrepreneurs and people like that. What is it about Guy's podcast that you like?
I love it. One of our neighbours up here actually put me onto it. And I don't know. I think he's telling stories of people that, well, let's take an example. Ben and Jerry's, great ice cream. Who doesn't love Ben and Jerry's? But how they started was so small, and just, I suppose it keeps it real for those that might be looking to scale and just think this mountain is too huge. But when you listen to these stories of these founders, you're like, oh my God, actually they were going through all the ups and downs that you hear other small businesses go through, and those that choose to do that and want to scale, etc. The stumbles they have, they're real people. They make mistakes. They're not foolproof. And I think Guy, he's a great listener, but is able to dig deep enough that I think he gets to the real stories of people. I mean, it's very easy to put on a bit of a superficial show, but digs deep enough, keeps it interesting. And for me, I'm always scrolling through trying to find the food sort of case studies, etc. And I think for me, I just love this. I'm going to sound a bit wanky here. I just love excellent businesses. Like they're really cool. Whether it be the business model, usually the business model, their products are great. But for me, it's always been about the skill set or the things you learn are always transferable to other industries. So it doesn't matter if you're listening to an automotive case study, a medicinal case study, or a food case study. There's always nuggets of gold that you can pull out, either apply to your own business or the industry you're in at least.
100% agree. And I think I find that I listen to all those different types of podcasts and I'm thinking like, how could this apply? Or even going down the street looking at a billboard or something like that and being like, how's the way they've done that applicable to what we do? And I think that's the interesting thing about business. I want to pick you up on, why would you say it's a little bit wankerish? Why have you undersold it there?
Oh, no. I just feel like I put myself in the category of serious data nerd or serious business model nerd and things like that. I mean, even like I sit in a cafe. This is going to make me sound, yeah, really embarrassing. Anyway, I sit so early on in the podcast. Great. I sit in a cafe and I'm sitting there counting how many coffees are being turned over in a 1 minute period, how many staff you've got there, like wandering the floor, or better still, not doing anything, just sort of counting. And I see all that as waste in the sense of continuous improvement and lean, not in the sense of food waste. And I just look like, go, okay, how could this be improved? Or what would I do differently? Or what could I take away from this business? And yeah, sorry, that's probably why I feel like it was a bit wanky or a bit embarrassing. I should probably be enjoying the coffee.
No, I'll embarrass myself here because we've got this amazing business here in Geelong. It's called Bean Squares. It's all locally owned. It's drive-through coffee. The guy who set it up, he might own, probably undersell it here, like 6 or 7 of these different drive-throughs. And I'll sit there and go in and order, or you see that there's 6 or 7 cars before you and you think, okay, if every car's ordering one coffee, it's about $5, $25, $50 per car. If those cars are buying 2 coffees, or every second car's buying 2 coffees, all of a sudden, like, his wages are paid for in the cars that are sitting in the drive-through right now. And it's like,
I know. I love it. It's great. But I have no clue where that's come from. It's just, I don't know. It's not like my parents. I don't think my parents were that way inclined. And dad may have been. He was engineer based, like data driven as well. But yeah, I don't know. It's cool that I can't help it.
So why farming for you? Tell me a little bit more about your family and like where you call home now, where you grew up, and how have you ended up back in the industry?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up sort of between here on the Allen River at a place called Eccleston and Maitland. So I think for 40 years ago, my parents were probably quite progressive because I think what I'm about to describe was probably normal now and not back then, where dad would be dairy farming for most of the week and then share farmer, they might switch on the weekend and dad would come down to Maitland where I was because school was closer there. And then he'd also act like the chauffeur driving us, my brother and I, to left, right and centre to sports constantly. So massive, keen sports person. And then I think, yeah, a lot of weekends and a lot of holidays up here at the farm. And then I suppose after that, school led to chemical engineering. I loved maths, and which is, I think, no surprise after the beginning of this conversation. maths and sciences. And I think back then you were choosing it from a 2 or 3 sentence paragraph in the UAC guide. And I was like, chemical engineering. And I wouldn't have had a clue what jobs would come from that. But I thought, yeah, I can do maths and chemistry. Let's have a crack at this. So I was at Sydney Uni. I did a combined chemical engineering and commerce degree and went to Women's College, which is another story in itself. Absolutely. Like that just opened my eyes. I mean, I suppose the theme there is the people you're hanging around with are really going to lift you up, open your eyes to all these opportunities out there.
So let's chat about that because I'm interested going, well, let's just grab this one and run with it. Moving from Maitland, like only a couple of hours north of Sydney, but then moving into literally the heart and soul of Sydney, just there in Darlinghurst or wherever the campus is. What was that like? And tell me more about that experience with Women's College.
Look, I think college was a great eye-opener and introduction, mostly because I think I was the only person from my school that went to Women's College, which was absolutely fabulous. All of a sudden you become anonymous again and you can, if you wanted to, you could recreate yourself. And I loved that both at uni and college. And for those, I mean, those that might not know what college in Australia is basically where you live versus universities where you go and, do your academic work. But college also had all the pastoral care around it. So you were being fed, you were being mentored. And I think I was really lucky enough that the principal at the time there was Quentin Bryce. So I went through, she was there the whole time through my freshman year to my fourth year. And I suppose for me, I was able to work quite closely with Miss Bryce. We definitely call it Miss Bryce or QB or Your Excellency, whatever you'd like to call Miss Bryce now. But I was senior student in my fourth year. So it was just fabulous to get an insight into how she operated as a human being, which was just kind of cool in itself, and to take on a leadership role within the college. But at the same time, attend uni and then do your work placements and things like that, which then obviously started to open things up to what chemical engineering might look like.
And did you find, like, if you think now in terms of some of the ways you think about business or communicating or anything like that, are there moments where Quentin, QB, was communicating that you kind of refer back to how she operated?
She had has a couple of great sayings. I think one of them is, you can have it all, but just not all at once. And for me, that has resonated a lot, possibly mostly in the last 2 years. I have a 2-year-old, and having a 2-year-old, like I'm a solo parent, so I decided to do that by myself, but that's another rabbit hole. But having a two-year-old whilst running a farming business, wow, it's insane. I think I was a little naive to do that. And I think you sort of constantly go back to, well, not constantly, but I do go back to those words by Quentin, and I saw her last year and sort of repeated that back to her. And she's like, yeah, Sarah, I'll give you a couple of years. And then it's, you know, straight into it. And she's totally right. Like, I feel now as I'm only getting some clarity in the last month or so about like getting my, I'm just going to say this out, like getting my brain back. Like, I'm impressed so far that I've been able to construct some sentences for you here, Ollie. Sorry. lacking sleep is a big thing. And I found it extraordinarily hard the last 2 years, but no, she was right. And I think I'm getting a bit of clarity now as to what's next for the business, but it certainly felt like I've been in survival mode the last 18 months, 2 years.
I'd love to ask you some questions about the family side. If you're happy to, you can also tell me no, thank you.
Yeah, go for it. That's all good.
And I love that quote. I reckon someone's, well, I've definitely heard it several times before, but I reckon it was someone on the podcast, and I believe it was a female, and I'm pretty damn sure they probably have ties back into Sydney Uni as well, whoever that might be. But like the decision to solo parent and go down that pathway, did you have to consciously decide that, okay, right now, family is the pathway I want to go down? And so in that sense, business might have to sit on the sideline?
I think I wish I'd had that clearer thought about it, because then that probably would have managed my expectations a little. It would have been like, this is good business, Ken. Treadwater, and Ken, we've set it up so that I think Nuffield, being away from my Nuffield scholarship helped with that too, because that set me up to work on the business rather than in the business the whole time. So like there were a lot of pivots that had to happen during going through things like IVF and having Grace, my little one. But yeah, it was a deliberate thought. It was probably quite a well, 5 or 6 years ago. It was like, okay, I'm back home. I don't think, do I want to do this? And what does that look like? And it's certainly impacted the business. I mean, that's a no-brainer. Mostly because I think the role I'm doing or the business I'm running is so hands-on, as in out in the paddock, things like that. So from a physical perspective, for a little while, I was unable to be out in the paddock, which for a control freak such as myself, it was different. It was big. It was like I think I was in the tractor moving chicken caravans as part of the egg business until I was about 7 or 8 months pregnant, and then it was just all too hard to fit behind the steering wheel. And that was okay, because that was a gradual wind down to someone else taking over that gig. And look, there's lots of that sort of stuff. But Grace actually comes with me on to most things that I do out in the paddock. And look, hasn't always. There's been the sort of brace on the front with Grace, sort of if I'm fixing a pump or something like that, it was perfect when she couldn't move. But then all of a sudden she started walking. So I'm like, oh, okay, we need to navigate this a little bit differently. So I think the government calls it an in-home care program, because I'm quite a distance. Well, it would be 3.5-4 hours to put Grace in daycare, sort of a round trip, like there and back twice a day, sort of. Probably 3 to 3.5 if you, yeah. But so that takes a chunk out of your day. But I think, I'm not sure which government sort of piloted the program of in-home care, but that has been fabulous for me. It has allowed me to sort of step out and do that certain times of the day. But reality is, running a chicken business, a lot of stuff happens at nighttime. So yeah, there's been those sort of constraints, I'd say, but you just do things differently. I think the last 4 or 5 years I've been, for example, we've spent so much, like hundreds of thousands on fencing to go from 20-odd paddocks in a 1,500-acre property to over 65, mostly so that I can, as an individual by myself, move cattle very easily, et cetera. So that's just been advantageous now. There's nothing manual or heavy or whatever involved with that, and Grace can be with me in the side-by-side. But the positive effect, I mean, the positives are a no-brainer. You start your day, if you're talking about it from a business perspective, all of a sudden you become much more organized and much better planned. I realized how off the cuff and how spur of the moment I was a lot with what I was doing during the day. And I feel like I was often, must have been fighting fires, and it was going, wow, that's not the best way to run a business. And that wouldn't have been how I would have operated in the corporate world. Yet I think I'd slipped into that. So now planning out the week to a certain degree, which will involve a level of childcare or involve a little much more logistics, has actually been really beneficial from a business perspective. I mean, there's also massive pros just of having a little one running around and just being part of your life. I mean, that's super exciting. And yeah, don't get down that rabbit hole, because that's kind of cool.
And drags you away from the business a little bit too, because
100%.
Which would be so beneficial.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there is definitely that. And Grace doesn't sleep. It's like, so I think for the first 18 months, I was on 40-minute or at most two-hour sleep cycles for, you know, through the night. So there's that element of, if you really dug a little bit deeper there, you'd be like, I don't know if I was making great decisions. So it's super handy to be the business to be able to run. It was, on reflection, it was probably taking me a little longer to make good decisions.
Yeah. So let's go back to working at BHP, huge, big business in the chemical engineering space. Look, one, maybe what were those experiences like? And do you still find yourself drawing on things today that you picked up when you stepped into those initial roles straight out of university?
Absolutely. I loved my time at BHP. Actually, to be honest, I feel really lucky. All the corporate roles I've had have all ended on really great terms, sort of doors always open sort of conversations. And I think the philosophy has always been just keep adding to your toolkit. Like, whichever role you take, make sure you're learning something new. And with BHP, that was, learn a lot. Even in the first week, I think I learned about 50 new swear words just from, I was on a mine site. I was in the middle of, I was over in WA, and it was pretty cool. So I was in Bunbury, which was a fabulous spot. If you're going to be on a mine site, to be living pretty much like in a coastal town and only traveling half an hour, 40 minutes to work, that was kind of cool. Especially as a young person, there was a great bunch of chemical engineers and sort of people under the age of 30 there as well, making Bunbury your home. But I actually came back from London. I was also doing, I was working for a consulting firm in London, and I'd done a thesis with BHP back in Newcastle in 2003, I think. And they rang out of the blue, my old boss from Newcastle, and said, hey, there's a couple of gigs going, one in Townsville, one in Bunbury, that we think you might be interested in. And so I had a look, and they were called Lean Six Sigma Black Belt roles, and I had no clue what that meant. Researched it a little and thought, oh, this is something I'd be super into. And yeah, came back for the interviews, and my time at BHP was a couple of years of doing continuous improvement projects or looking at processes on that particular mine site. And I think a lot of people think when you think about process improvement or continuous improvement, you're always looking for cost reductions. And look, I think the takeaway for me was it wasn't about removing people from the process by any means. It was actually working with the teams that are doing this work every day to find better ways of doing it, and mostly driven by their suggestions of improvement that remove waste from the process. So stop doing things that you don't need to do. Let's create an environment where you don't have to rework things. Like, there's so many elements to learning to be or have a culture of lean or continuous improvement, and BHP was certainly well on the way when I was there, and absolutely loved it.
I think that's one of the things with big businesses, isn't it, that you like they have the ability to invest in programs and things like that. The other, we'll keep giving BHP a plug here, because the other thing that I absolutely love that they do, and it's their Instagram channel, inside_BHP, because I look at it a lot. But it's quite cool for what is such a big behemoth of a corporate. It's actually just all their everyday people doing things. And from someone who's driving the dump truck to someone else who's an engineer or something, to then the bloke who's in the office talking about, of course I can make the horn on the dump truck do a honk from 1,000 kilometers away. And it's like the innovation and what sits behind these businesses is actually just amazing. I think it'd be fascinating to be inside it.
And they invest in their people. To your point, they have the resources or set aside the resources or prioritize it to invest in people. And as an employee, I mean, you love that you could then actually use those skills straight away to help the business. I just found that fabulous. Like, I've used the lean, I mean, I get my kicks out of that continuous improvement stuff. Like, it's data driven, but it's also from a culture of change. Also, just focusing, the main drive being let's focus on the customer, whether that's an internal customer or external. But again, transferable across every industry I've been in since then.
What was the reason to leave there and go back to studying?
I think I'd always had ambitions to do some further study. Like, there was not a reason necessarily to leave BHP. It was just, I wanted to do some study. I think I was about 28 at the time. And I think I thought, let's go and do it. Now, I was actually, that's because I went to Oxford. I think the average age at Oxford for doing your MBA is a little bit older than some of the US courses. So I already felt like I was going to want to be the oldies in this course. So I just thought, why now? Why not now? And yeah, so, and BHP were very generous. I mean, they would have happily paid for the MBA, but I think for me, from an ethical perspective, I wasn't confident I was going to return to be to the mining industry when I came back. I didn't know. I didn't have a clue. I didn't know what I was going to do. So it was, I really wanted to do it myself and ended up lucky enough to get a scholarship. So yeah, that was very helpful.
If you had your time again, would you have taken that funding and done it a different way or not?
Well, I don't think so. I think the path since then has been one that's led me back to here, knowing that I always wanted to get back to the farm, wasn't sure when. Again, it's always you sort of taking the opportunities as they arise. And I think I feel very comfortable having put yourself through it or sort of in your own stripes, done it that way. But look, if someone's going to offer you the opportunity to go and study at these institutions, jump at it. Absolutely. Yeah.
Did you find the MBA useful? Like, because I guess I look at it and I think, well, one, I don't know if I've got any capacity to take on further hex debt. That's a rant for another time. But looking at it, do you think if you were to go back into it now, would you do an MBA or would you look at other short courses of forms? What did you get out of it?
Really good question. I think I started the MBA, then the GFC hit. So I think a lot of people at the time in the MBA were very nervous because all of a sudden people across the globe were being made redundant and there was no way they were going to employ some 25 to 35-year-old that had no experience in an industry, because most people historically would use an MBA, well, in my experience, would have used that MBA to, what do they call it, triple jump, sort of switch from industry type of role and maybe even country. That's historically what used to happen. I think I still would have done the MBA, and the academic side, absolutely, it was great. But to your point, I think you could get all of that academic piece from shorter, more intense courses. But I think the value for me, and possibly the reason I wanted to go in the first place, was the people you meet. Oh my God, like you turn up, it was just extraordinary. I mean, I wanted to row and play cricket over there. And yes, I got to do that, but also got to meet these people that were just doing such extraordinary things, whether they be, again, I stayed at, you know, I was living in college there, so rowed for college, but the people in the MBA had at least sort of anywhere from 4 to 10 years work experience under their belt in industries half the time and roles that you just never heard of. I think the biggest stumbling block for me coming out of as an undergraduate, you just didn't know what you could do, like what was possible. So any opportunity to see or hear about roles, yeah, is pretty valuable.
And coming from that background of people from all kind of walks of life from all around the world, did agriculture kind of pop up in conversations as such, or was it more that you really had to kind of search and try hard to go, well, I know what my roots are, I know where I want to end up, so I'm going to look extra hard for where this could be applied and have opportunities through ag?
Yes. Yeah. The second part of that, you're spot on. I think, and it was actually became pretty hard for me in a later step trying to find corporate agricultural roles, but I can chat about that later. But yeah, I think a lot of people, again, this, I don't know if this is this case anymore. I don't know if it's relevant anymore. A lot of people were looking to step into management consulting or investment banking. It was a complete stereotype.
Yeah.
100%. So I was completely going against the grain because I was looking for agri or food and agri mostly. I mean, I did interviews for places like Shell and other organizations because you want interview practice as well. Like you really want, so that when that job does come up, you want to be ready. So, yeah, I ended up, I think I got my role, I worked for Syngenta straight out of Oxford, but I got that role pretty early on before the MBA actually finished. But that was because I actually chased someone. There wasn't a graduate role or anything like that, but I went looking for that role. But yes, you're right. I think it was very limited. I don't think many people were in there looking at agricultural roles after an MBA.
Because I just think about it now and well, yeah, all I can do is make assumptions, but I would not be surprised if agriculture is still not part of the conversations. But it's like you look at where the world's heading, remove it from the finance point of view, but from a climate, environment, food, nutrition, sustainability, all those things. Like if ag is not being case studies and front and center in terms of opportunities. It's really on our industry to be like, how do we get into those rooms? How do you create the case studies? Because it's all there.
I think that's all I only found out or heard about. I didn't even know about Syngenta through a case study. It was the Golden Rice case study. And that was something we studied at Oxford in a subject called Managing Information in the Bioeconomy. But it really, I think you're right. But I think some of the massive corporates, like the likes of Cargill, et cetera, like those guys are doing their thing and you're having those discussions. So at the meet and greet, it's a stereotype as everyone would imagine it to be. Like the corporates are there. I'm just using the wrong word. It's not the right word at all. It's a networking event. It's like there's not a lot of cash spent or anything like that. It's just you're in the room with people that you could potentially work for. Again, it's opening your eyes to what's available. But I just think it's changed so much in, what's that? That's 15 years ago. I really feel like it has changed. Like I'm old, really.
I was just finishing high school.
Great. Thank you. I really think it's changed. I think people now would be certainly seeking out roles. They'd be, and I think employers are shaping roles more now to people, to great people. Like they realize that talent is hard to find. If you get it, you need to shape the role to the talent to keep it or to get those outcomes that you're chasing.
Yeah, no, definitely. What was it like working across Europe? Those big markets, lots of consumers, lots of money.
Lots of all that, lots of language differences. I think when I was in Switzerland to start with, I felt got a little bit isolated because you're the Aussie there that only speaks English. Literally, I felt like the biggest bogan ever. Because everyone else spoke at least three languages. Like, that's what it was like. And it felt like, oh, that we better switch to English for Sarah. I'm like, excellent. But it was great. I spent my time mostly working in a business, like the business arm that was focused on food security. And that was mostly for smallholder farmers, so less than an acre or less than 2 acres, and what that might look like moving into the future, which was. It was very cool. I wasn't in Switzerland for a long time because I think at that point, I think I actually came home because my father was unwell. So I moved back to Oz for a little while, and then that's when I took up the gig with the World Bank.
Amazing. Farming in Australia is never without opportunity nor its challenges. From season to season and from day to day, producers manage a variety of risks and rewards as they produce the vast range of commodities global markets are now demanding. ANZ have been supporting Aussie farmers to take opportunities and manage through challenges for over 150 years. They're a proud and long-term partner of Nuffield Australia, supporting its goal of capacity building for producers, their businesses, industry and rural community. Their network of regionally based agribusiness bankers are ready to support both their existing customers and any farming businesses seeking a review of their banking arrangements at any time. Find your local ANZ agribusiness manager at anz.com. So let's talk about coming home. You've literally been around the world. You've worked in huge, huge businesses. What were the opportunities? Why did you want to come home?
I know that I'm a homebody. It was always on the radar. And I think I was reflecting on this only recently because I knew this interview was coming up and I thought you might ask me that question. It was more around I started to go, why? What do I want to do? And I think I knew I wanted to be part of a business that I would have a little bit more control over, was a little bit more agile. And yes, it's lovely coming back to the farm. That's great. But I think what I was actually coming back to was a business that I could influence. And I don't know. I think I still would have, for example, it could have been a ginger beer business. I think I was trying to go, was it the business? Was it the location? I think it was a bit of everything, but I definitely wanted to have a crack at running my own business.
Mm-hmm. The ginger beer business, that was a legitimate, when you were coming home, you really wanted to bring an enterprise back. Is that right?
Yeah, I think you feel like you've learned a lot and there was still so much more to learn, but it was like, is there an opportunity to use some skills, especially around the process improvement piece and things like, and that's probably why I ended up in pasteurized eggs. I could have quite easily, I think, stepped back into dairy farming with the process piece. Like that would have been very attractive to me because a lot of those businesses, I feel you can make a tweak and an incremental improvement and you can see the results of that or the change of that very quickly. The beef business, which I still run here, we run somewhere between 250 and 300 cows and their calves. But I felt that was a slower moving business, if that's right. And it's also obviously commodity driven, whereas I wanted to start a business that I could have a strong control over the price of the product.
Yeah. And eggs were the natural fit once you started to look a little bit deeper into where you were, markets, et cetera.
Oh, there were a few. Ginger beer was actually one I looked at. I think I don't drink. So I was like, what? I really love ginger beer and was like, is it something? I love the process piece. Again, how you manufacture it. I did my uni work experience with Carlton United Breweries in Broadway in Sydney, went before it got turned into apartments and knocked down, but loved it. Like my first gig there was actually as a beer taste tester. I could not believe it. They're like, okay, Sarah, what we need you to do is taste all these different samples of beer. They'd pulled samples from different parts of the line and they dose it with tastes that could mean you've got to be able to pick up whether the beer has gone off at certain parts of the manufacturing process. And I don't know why, but somehow I was okay at that. And it just, and then you basically spent the next 3 months working in that manufacturing plant, which I just, yeah, loved. So hence, liked the idea of ginger beer, but ended up with eggs because of more about the demand, I thought, and the research I'd done with potential customers.
And so the egg business, what did it look like when you first set it up, established it? What were the ambitions for it back then?
It had to be a business that would complement the beef side of things. So it definitely and still doesn't impact the number of head of cattle or kilograms of beef that we produce. As I said before, it was going to be great to be able to control the price of your product. But I think for me, it also needed to be, if possible, some sort of predictable cash flow and not severely influenced by external factors. So hence with the eggs, for me, it was never going to be about producing eggs that were going to sit in a supermarket or a grocery store or something like that. It was always going to be about direct to the consumer. It was like, how do we choose the model? So that's how the egg subscription business came about.
Yeah, gotcha. And the subscription, like as I was looking into it, like bloody fascinating in the sense of trying to meet the customers where they are. But then, and this is my take on it. So if I'm correct, you use different cafes and local retailers as kind of your collection point and outlet, which then one gives customers somewhere which they're familiar with to go and collect it. But two, it also creates this community where the businesses that are stocking your products would become a whole lot more invested in supporting you because there would be crossover benefits to, say, someone coming in and ordering a coffee while they collect their dozen eggs, et cetera.
Absolutely. That's the theory. And I'd say 95% of the time, that's how it works. You spot on. People, it's almost like a gym membership, I suppose. People sign up and $12 is subtracted from their credit card every week, say on a Monday. The eggs theoretically are not laid till, say, Wednesday, even Thursday, and the delivery takes place on the Friday because we also have wholesale customers. And, yeah, you're right, that person then comes in and picks their eggs up from the cafe that we've delivered to. And if they don't collect the eggs, so some people will realise they've reached peak egg and don't need any more eggs in their fridge this week, and they just leave them there for the week and we'll pick those up and we donate them straight to OzHarvest or a rescue kitchen. So that was always part of the business. The business needed to have some sort of social impact. So just as an underlying part of operating, around approximately 5% of our production always goes through to a rescue kitchen or OzHarvest.
And is there a feel-good aspect there for the customers? So if I was your customer and I'm at peak egg, so I haven't gone and collected them, when I go back in the next week, or do I get like a message being like, hey, Ollie, thanks for your subscription this week. We've donated your eggs, or do they get anything like that?
No, they'll know that their eggs have gone, but we don't necessarily know it was you, Ollie, that didn't pick up your eggs because their name isn't on the egg cart. All I know is that there's 3 dozen eggs left at this particular cafe, and they go straight to the rescue kitchen. But they're very aware. So every time we get a new customer, I'll ring them and have this exact conversation with them, mostly also to manage expectations because, as you can imagine, it's a different type of customer behaviour to pay for something in advance, turn up each week and pick up these eggs, and then all of a sudden you've paid, but my eggs aren't there because I'm actually here on the 8th day rather than the 7th day. And so you really want to manage that expectation that your eggs aren't going to be there if you don't pick them up in that first 7 days. I think there is a little bit of a feel-good factor. I think it was a why not? Would you just do this anyway as part of your business? Like, yeah, that was a no-brainer for us to include that in the business model.
And how's that benefited? One, that sounds like a huge amount of work, but how's it benefited you having that direct contact with your customers, and two, actually having the flow-on impact that if someone isn't, using the product, that it's still going to a good use?
I think it's a significant amount of, we've set it up. So the marketing or creative agency that helped me do the design for Just Been Laid and also the, like all the packaging, the website, everything, they were really critical in that when I'd given them the brief around how do we do this predictable cash flow piece, they, it, I certainly can't claim credit for coming up with this, with the subscription for eggs. Like that was a joint sort of, it was that like a brainstorming piece about would people do this? Would people even be a part of this? There's a little bit of work involved. The platform that we use enables most of the technology behind the scenes to just take care of delivery lists, payment gateways, all that sort of stuff. I think where it becomes more intensive and what we're looking at the moment is if customers have the option to pause or stop for a while or things like that, all of a sudden it becomes very custom and you need to have like focus on that. So we don't see pausing a lot. So it's probably something we're sort of looking at as to whether we want to continue to offer it.
And so how many customers do you guys have across? Is it mainly out of Newcastle?
Yeah. So we produce around, we only have about 1,500 chickens here now with the egg business. We reduced that a little bit after COVID. So there's a couple of hundred subscribers. So around 250 dozen, I think, go out every week just to subscribers, because you have people out there that go through 3-4 dozen eggs a week. It's not me.
But, my God.
Yeah, I know. And during COVID.
Just cooking paths.
Yeah, absolutely. During COVID, I think everyone was baking at home, because at times we'd get subscribers saying, can you add another 3 dozen to my order? And I was like, okay, sure. What are you doing? Yeah. So but that's probably 30 or 40% of our business. The other part is those cafes that act as collection points are often using kitchen eggs as well. So that's where the rest of the eggs will go.
Interesting. Is there, and so when I first heard about this idea, I was like, wow, is that the potential, call it HelloFresh, but that direct-to-consumer subscription food model, is there an opportunity to, for these different cafes to one be, as you say, users of the product, but actually a collection point? So the carrots, whatever, bit of beef, things come into these cafes. Like, do you think there's scalability in this model?
I think the scalability comes from increasing the number of cafe points as opposed to, yes, there is an opportunity to increase the offering, absolutely. But I think some of the problems when I said they're about it works 95% of the time, I think it probably works 99% of the time. The hiccups we have is that a couple of collection points, for example, just are getting too popular. There's too many subscribers, and cafes, as you would know, when you're there counting the coffees and looking at the floor space and how much money they're making, they don't have the space to then put in a fridge for Just Been Laid necessarily, unless they're doing the maths going, that's okay, all these subscribers that are coming in are then also buying coffee. Like that discussion, we're getting at that growing pain point with a few of our hubs actually, and having some quite robust discussions, because the cafes don't clip the ticket. They don't. They're not taking like a percentage of the egg revenue. So we might need to revisit how that works in the future. But I do wonder if they started offering other products, just the space. It's really just a space thing.
Yeah. No, my mind just goes a million miles an hour on that and going, well, is there like a franchisee model which comes in? So it's like they do get to clip the ticket, but do you, as the initial kind of customer point of contact, have your lead being the eggs, but then be able to tack in other companies, so then you get a percentage and then the cafe, like,
yep. And that hunt, people doing honey and bread come to us with that suggestion as well. I can totally see things like, you know what I actually see, and we were chatting with the creative guys yesterday, is this sort of, okay, you know when you drive, you're in a rural town, sometimes you see that the honesty box type situation where people might buy some backyard eggs for $5 and leave the money in the little container. Sort of thinking about, is there, I hope I'm not really giving away too much here, but you've got a space in the CBD that is like completely unmanned but has a code. So you've got subscribers or members in our case, probably more than subscribers, that can have that code. They can go in there, but in there, there's no human in there, but you've got your fridge with all your eggs, and what we're looking at now is our Just Been Laid pantry products. So that would be quiches, curds, custards, any egg value-added product. But you've also got your bait, like your breads, you've got your milk, whatever, in this piece where people can buy, scan, and pay for. So it's something that we're certainly thinking about at the moment, so that you can have those other offerings in the one spot. But it changes that customer behavior. Like, would we be able to swing our customers to now go to a different collection point where they probably like getting their coffee when they currently pick up their eggs. I don't know. It's a sort of pilot plan potential.
Yeah. Have you seen that humanless butcher shop, which is that exactly as you talk about?
No, that sounds super cool.
I'll send you the details after this.
Absolutely. It also reminds me of, say, vending machines, or in the UK when you've got your vending machine, like Fen Farm Dairy, beautiful cheeses in the UK. But you can buy the cheese, you can buy the raw milk, you can buy everything at the farm gate, and there's no human there. It's just that, but bring that idea back here.
Well, I reckon vending machines, I was in Japan at the start of this year, it's a good plug there, and on holidays, which has been a big part of this year. Millie will love that because she's into me that I tell everyone I went to Japan and on holidays. But they have vending machines everywhere, and it's like there's got to be, it's not revolutionary stuff, but like there was, and it was bizarre, you could press at the same vending machine, get a cold drink, or you could get a hot, like get an ice, or you can get an iced coffee, or you could get a coffee can, which was actually warmed up, or you could get a tin of corn, and the tin of corn was hot. Like it was amazing what was kind of at the one machine and how it could hit your needs.
Yeah. They do that in the Netherlands as well. Like as part of when I was traveling, doing that research in our field, that some egg farmers were struggling with their, say their contract, or felt like they could be making additional money or a different revenue stream. But they're so close, like to Amsterdam or wherever the farms were, like kilometres away rather than, 60 kilometres. And they just had a vending machine at their barn door and working so well.
Yeah. God, I need to go travel again, make it a work trip, not holidays. Let's talk about your Nuffield. You've done a great conduit there, Sarah. Your Nuffield topic was really around looking at how small businesses could potentially compete with the big guys and what was their point of kind of difference. Is that right? Like not necessarily about economies of scale becoming the biggest player, but actually how could you still be profitable and hit your needs by pursuing excellence, which I love.
Yeah, I think so. It was really about farming businesses that had that passion for excellence. And it was a complete deal with pride moment from a book I was reading called Small Giants. What was it called? Small Giants Companies. Oh, yeah, companies that choose to be great instead of big. Great read. Like, it's just super cool. It's by Bo Burlingham. Companies that choose to be great instead of big, I think, is the name.
Onto it. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. It's just really cool. You just go, actually, that's right. There's so many businesses out there that are just absolutely fabulous at what they do and resist the urge to scale or multiply or whatever and still are extraordinarily successful financially and in whatever else however else they measure success. So for me, it was going and looking at farming businesses that haven't necessarily scaled or might have been before the point of scale, or just really looking at what are these businesses doing differently to others. And so that was what the Nuffield sort of travel was about. And yeah, it was so cool because I think the problem with Nuffield is, if there is a problem, is that you get so excited about what you see over there and so energized that all of a sudden you come back and straight away you're like, oh my God, I can do this, this and this. And you really have to restrain. I think the people that have been around the Nuffield block a few times have sort of like, look, take a breath, give it 6 or 12 months before you do anything, because it is a bit of a risk from that perspective. But yeah, look, the main findings were really around how these businesses interacted with their customers. I think there were, from memory, this is again, you're testing me 5 years ago. So I think the main findings were around these businesses were really, really close, and not geographically close, but close to their customers. They understood their customers. They at times were almost able to predict what their customers would want or need. I was classifying that as a level of customer sort of intimacy. They would also choose their customers and choose who they didn't want as customers. They were really specific around that. And I think the other piece was they had this emotional connection, or their customers had an emotional connection with the product or business. And it was really cool. I don't know. Do you want me to describe a couple of businesses or not?
Yeah, I would love to. Yeah, because this is pretty well what I'm trying to work through myself at the moment. So thank you.
I think, this can be applied across, again, any of the industries. It's just that I happen to be visiting food and farm businesses. But you could take, there was a turkey business called Kelly Bronze, run by a gentleman called Paul Kelly. I looked today on his website to actually just remind myself how much he was selling his turkeys for. This is at Christmas time in the UK. And they sell from anywhere, depending on weight, from $150 Australia to $400 Australian dollars. And this is a 6-week turnaround time at the Christmas time. And Paul, he'd done many things. He realized how valuable sort of the emotional connection piece was. And he, for example, had partnered with quite a few influencers. This is well before social media influencers, but had partnered with the likes of Jamie Oliver, Nigella, Gordon Ramsay, etc., to invest or validate the product. Like, talk about why their product was so, using words like natural, born to be wild, like, and it wasn't marketing spin. Like, you'd go on the tour. Like, Paul took me through from it. Like, everything was done by hand, whether it be the plucking, the waxing of the bird, etc., the genetics that were brought in from the US to the UK to change the color of the, like, so that the bird had different colored feathers, etc. It was just really fascinating to see. He then, when it got to the time of packaging and the product itself, he didn't just give people a turkey. It would be, here's your thermometer so that you don't overcook it, because it was a slow food. There was a risk of using temperatures that you might use from a slightly different type of turkey to cook. But here is all the equipment you need to have an absolutely perfect Christmas lunch. But Paul would go and spend time with his customers. He'd sit around the table with them while they were eating some turkey, to like sort of more of an ethnographic study, to be like, this is what the customer needs, as opposed to sort of making the assumption about it. Sorry, I could keep going forever on these other examples.
Oh, it is fascinating.
Sorry. It's just like, because even like there's a strawberry producer in the Netherlands. His big pitch was, Sarah, you need to be close to your customer, not geographically, but be in his world. His value proposition was that we're flexible. A wholesale customer can ring me in the morning at 8 a.m. By 11 a.m., we'll have his strawberries packed in a certain way and delivered en route, being delivered, because he had a direct line to him. But you go and have a look at the strawberries. He realized that only 20% of his product was going to hit the criteria for, say, the Japanese market. The Japanese were willing to pay a 30% premium if Marcus could guarantee that every one of the strawberries was between 13 and 15 grams. Every strawberry had been placed in the same position, like same angle in the punnet. It had bubble wrap underneath. And the cream on the top was, we'll pay you more, Marcus, if you're able to, in the Japanese market, get rid of those dead leaves that you see in the bottom of a strawberry punnet. So as a true farmer, came up with a really basic solution, which was putting the punnets on a conveyor, blowing some compressed air into the punnet, the leaves just fly out onto the floor, and all of a sudden there's a 30% premium on that product, with the remaining 80% of product potentially going to somewhere like the European market. Again, he was removing waste from the process by picking the product, and it was going straight into the box or packaging that would then go into the store. There was not double handling or anything like that. I mean, this is all a lot of common sense. I certainly don't want to preach that it's, but getting those processes in place and making sure the product is still good by the time it reaches the customer is actually, I think, a lot harder than some people might think.
Well, and it's the care, isn't it? By going, like, how do you, if you've got that relationship with your customer, you're more likely to care about, well, yeah, is it likely to go sour or be bruised or something between now and 2 days' time or not?
I think there's that. And they just also, these guys had been doing it for so long that they realized, and I think there's a great Harvard Business Review article that shows that you actually want to convert, you want your customers to be emotionally connected, but you're trying to convert them from highly satisfied to emotionally connected. You don't want to spend your time. There's three times more value doing that than trying to convert people that are unsatisfied to satisfied. So if you've got thick enough skin and you're happy to drop the unsatisfied to satisfied customers, focus on those high-end customers. They're not high-end because of money. They're high-end because of the value they create. They recommend you. They're an advocate for your product. There's a level of forgiveness when things go wrong. Like, there's so many things about why you would want to do that.
Yeah. So how do you then, and take that level of stimulation you get, as you said, kind of had to temper it and go, well, we're going from this level of thinking up here back down into the farm. How did you temper coming back in at a million miles an hour and making change, but also to keeping things on the horizon? And this is such a multi-layered question, but keeping things on the horizon, but also have that stimulation around you to know that, oh, let's go back to what we picked up in Nuffield, et cetera.
Yeah, as you can tell, my rate of speaking gets a lot faster when I'm getting excited about what I'm talking about. Apologies. I think all the time, especially when I was out traveling with Nuffield, you're in a bus with 8 or 9 other people, and it's the most interrogation you're going to get from your business model. So you've got to have a decently thick skin to be like, they're going to rip you to shreds in a good way. And you walk away going, okay, what am I doing that works? What doesn't? So by the time you get back to the farm after the scholarship,
I think you've had a lot of time to figure out which ideas you really want to put a lot more thought into. And you sort of start reflecting, going, am I doing this in my business? Which of these are going to be, I don't necessarily think you can do it all. It's very much, especially as a lot of small businesses. And yeah, for me, it was a reflection of which bit can I focus on now and sort of put in the plan for moving forward.
So where do you find that now? Because going from the circles you've been in, whether it was in corporate world into Nuffield, like now, how many people do you have in your business back home?
There's six of us here. It probably equates to about 2.5 people full time. But we have a lot, like we have dairy farmers up the road and people that run other small businesses that for egg collecting, grading, packaging, et cetera, it kind of fits well, school drop-offs and things like that. So yeah, we've got about six.
And so then you've also got this consumer-facing business as well as the farm business. How do you find that stimulation, the new ideas, the getting out of that bubble of the day-to-day? Like, where do you look for that?
Definitely podcasts for sure. And thank God for podcasts because I love reading as well. And I've got a pile of books beside my bed. But that's where conferences like getting back together with the likes of the Nuffield Scholars, or even just some potential industry conferences or field days. I'm also a research fellow for the Australian Farm Institute. So it's such a buzz being in a room. So I just sit there going, I don't even know why I'm in here. But like with people that are just doing super cool things and you go, you guys are pretty cool. And again, just talking about stuff that I don't think about day to day. So lifting you out of that is critical. And I think for me, I have to proactively do that, like actually, yeah, look for those opportunities.
Well, Sarah, maybe one or two other questions to finish on. What's on the horizon for you? What's kind of that next thing that you're looking forward to that's kind of driving you at the moment?
I think over the last probably 18 months, I think I've been building a new venue on farm because I think 2019 was a really hard year with the drought, et cetera, and you started to realise that you were so impacted by external things that you had no control over. That was from the beef perspective. The eggs have been quite solid, but the new building is for an agritourism piece, and this I'm hoping will do a few things, draw a different crowd here, also leverage our subscriber business. I often talk about the stickiness that you want with your customers. Like, we want to give them more and more reasons for more and more value that they see in the relationship they have with us, so that if we have a tough patch or if there's an inflection point where something goes wrong, it's an opportunity for them to be able to come closer to us and they won't leave. But also with something like this will have a farm shop in it. It'll be a place where cooking classes, art classes, it'll be a strategic planning day for corporates to come up here, spend the day on site and then have a facilitated team day. But I think for me, it's just a way of also pushing yourself, like to think about different things and to stretch yourself and challenge yourself again.
That's so exciting. you're going to go from looking at podcasts to having more stimulation than you need around you just with the different conversations and people that come into the space.
Bring it on, I say. Oh, it's so cool. I love it. Yeah.
It will be. Now, one question, and I did kind of go away for a little while, but with everything you've seen, everything you've learned about agriculture, I love to think of talking to the year 10 students about what a career in agriculture could kind of afford to them. But if you look at what you've seen and experienced in and around agriculture, what would you say to people about where the industry is heading and why should young people be looking at it as a career path?
It's a really good question. I think I have quite a range in age of people that work here, from a couple of 18, 19-year-olds through to sort of 65 plus. And it's really interesting at morning tea. That's where I love it, where the conversations happen and you just go, wow, the diversity in this chat and each learning from each other. It's mostly an age thing, a generational thing. And I love seeing the 18 or 19-year-olds push the buttons of the older generations, especially around the carbon or climate change, to be honest. Let's just be frank about it. And even just using, they're being great storytellers, these 18 or 19-year-olds, about these are your grandchildren, they're going to be affected. But like, they're being able to influence this discussion where some people have switched off to that debate. And so that's what I've enjoyed about that multi-generational workforce. But I think, and what I've said to all of our young guys is, and it's still true for me, is just to be keep adding to your toolkit. I think I've found, and it's been helpful for my career, that I have been able to switch industries, and that's purely been because of the skills that I've been keen to pick up in whichever industry you've been in, and they're applicable everywhere. Like, you can bring those skills back to agriculture, or you can start in agriculture and take them somewhere else. I wouldn't look at agriculture as a limiting career choice for a long-term career. It doesn't have, you don't have to stay in ag. You can start in it, you can leave it and then come back to it. You can start it and leave it, whatever. But those skills are available now, I believe, in organisations from all parts of the value chain.
Couldn't agree more. No, well, Sarah, thank you so much. I've really, really enjoyed our chat. We did have a little half-time or quarter-time intermission, but no, I really enjoy it. I think the business that you run is fascinating. I'm looking forward to learning more and more about it. But thank you for sharing it with me and with our audience.
Oh, thanks, Ollie. Pleasure to be involved.
Well, that's it for another episode from us here at Humans of Agriculture. We hope you're enjoying these podcasts, and well, if you're not, let us know. Hit us up at hello@humansofagriculture.com. Get in touch with any guest recommendations, topics, or things you'd like us to talk and get curious about. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. Rate, subscribe, review it. Any feedback is absolutely awesome, and we really do welcome it. So look after yourselves, stay safe, stay sane. We'll see you next time. See ya.